Hello and welcome to a special episode for the Spectators podcast. I'm Kate Andrews and I'm your host for the next 30 minutes. Conversations about modernizing the NHS have been happening for almost as long as the NHS itself. In the 2019 long-term plan...
Thank you very much, David, and Prime Minister, Secretary of State, my colleagues from across the NHS.
Announced by Sir Simon Stevens, until recently the head of NHS England, put so-called patient-centred care at the forefront, writing that the NHS also needs a more fundamental shift in how we work alongside patients and individuals to deliver more person-centred care, recognising, as National Voices has championed, the importance of what matters to someone is not just what's the matter with someone. All well and good, but then came COVID.
I urge you, at this moment of national emergency, to stay at home, protect our NHS, and save lives.
Between waves one and two, the NHS did try to get through its backlog of cancelled surgery and postponed appointments, but they had little hope. And today's record-breaking waiting times in England are a further reminder of the destruction of COVID.
The new Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, is warning that waiting lists could rise as high as 13 million people in the coming months. So where does that leave efforts to modernise the NHS now, and in particular for that patient-led vision that the long-term plan had set out? For this special episode of the Spectators podcast, I'll be asking this question of a panel of expert guests. Sir Jim Mackey is the head of Northumbria's NHS Trust and former head of NHS Improvement. Charlotte Augst is head of the National Voices, a coalition group for patient-centred health charities. And Todd Manning is the vice president and general manager of AbbVie UK, who are kindly sponsoring this podcast. Sir Jim, let's start with you. COVID has flooded NHS waiting lists. The health service just isn't fit to deal with this backlog, is it?
So I think, first of all, it's different across the NHS. So everybody, you know, that 11, 13, 15 million, whatever it is, isn't evenly spread. So from our institutional perspective in our local system, I would fully expect us to recover as we go into winter this year, whereas other organisations and other parts of the country that have been more disproportionately hit by COVID will take longer to go about that recovery period. So I think there's a danger in assuming this is just the same everywhere. And there's various reasons for that. So it hit different parts of the country in different ways. The resilience going in to COVID was different in different places. You know, the extent to which people were on top of waiting times pre-COVID as well was an important factor. So I'm always optimistic. The NHS has dealt with, you know, everything that's been thrown at it over the last 18 months. This is a tricky phase and recovery will be hard, but we'll absolutely find ways to recover. I think, if I'm honest, now is probably the time to have a conversation with the public about what the NHS can and should do over this maybe next five-year period, given what we've all been through. Rather than just everybody reverting to what we're doing before COVID, in my opinion, the public are up for an open conversation to say, we've been through a big shock. Everybody's been through a big shock. How would you like us to go about this next period? And I think that would be a really, really important thing to do, and with our staff as well. So the default is we just all go back and work harder and get very disappointed and frustrated about the rate of recovery and how tired everybody gets with that. I think it's probably one of those moments where we should stand back, take stock and listen to people.
Charlotte, presumably you want to see more patient-led healthcare. And to Jim's point about honesty, also a conversation with the public about realistically what a national health service can and cannot do.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, as National Voices, we are a coalition of health and care charities, and our members are very close to what people want and need right now and what they have experienced during the pandemic. Whenever we ask people what they actually expect, and we have during the pandemic done a piece of work that looked at people's experiences of waiting, you can find that on our website, it's called Patient Noun Adjective. I'm always struck by how little the public expects. When people ask me, don't we need a realistic conversation with the public, it always is sort of framed as in people expect far too much. What people said to us they expect was not for everything to return to normal in 5 minutes, to treat any disruption as a scandal, and to blame particularly not to blame hardworking health and care workers for the situation we now all find ourselves in. On the contrary, people were very grateful for all the hard work that they obviously could see had been going on. But what they were reporting when we asked them about their experiences of waiting was that they felt utterly abandoned and totally confused and in the dark as to what was actually going on. And what I took away from the conversations we've had was that people have a relationship with a service provider. They often have a relationship with a GP, and they have an implied relationship with a specialist. Even if they haven't seen this person, they feel like they should be under someone's care because someone has accepted their referral. And that relationship is really disrupted when you just get a letter that says, sorry, we had to cancel your operation. We will be in touch anon. And people felt like they were no one's problem. They have no idea what was going to happen next. And if you just think about the everyday experiences of waiting we have when we wait in the supermarket queue or wait at a department store, it's like it's being acknowledged. It's the worker at the till catching our eye and saying, I'll be with you in a second. That makes a massive difference to the experience. I mean, every time there's travel disruptions, they always take that away as learning, don't they? That it's all about the communication. And that's really what we've heard, is that clearly we can't do away with the need to accelerate access to treatments. I don't want to minimize that need because my members would kill me if I said that's not important. It's really important. But what's also really important is that we maintain a relationship with people. We can't do the thing for right now that they're expecting to do done, whether that's a hip replacement or an assessment or an eye surgery or whatever it is, and to offer support for what they're now up against. And actually, when I listened to the people we interviewed for our work, Patient Now and Adjective, I thought, that's doable. That is actually something services could do. We can't recover performance just like that, but we could write a decent letter and we could offer a phone call and we could point people in the direction of other support.
Todd, what qualities or improvements are you hoping to see as we come out of the pandemic?
Yeah, thanks. You know, it's interesting, the time that we've just lived through, if we want to refer to it as the acute pandemic phase, there are actually some positives that I think we can reflect upon. The first, I would say, is the collaboration that we saw between the public sector, the NHS, Department of Health, charitable organizations, as well as the private sector. I mean, in many ways, the collaboration was stronger than it had ever been. And I think that the UK can look back on that period as a period where that collaboration was specifically fundamental in terms of helping the country come out of that acute period and towards recovery. So I think the collaboration that we established during the acute part of the pandemic shouldn't be lost as we now start the recovery period. When you think about technology as an example, provides a huge burning platform there. But it's, I would say, the collaboration aspect, I would say openness to innovation, and then patient centricity. If you get those three qualities right, I think that we can recover as quickly as we have come out of the acute period.
Let's look at some of these things on the wish list. Charlotte, what does patient-led actually mean? If I were a patient, how would that care look or feel different to me?
That's obviously a question I get asked quite a lot. And my standard response to this, and I don't mean this in a glib way, is patients already lead their own healthcare. Patients are already doing most of the things that they need to live as well as possible. So the time people actually spend in a healthcare setting, even for very complicated and acute conditions, is very limited. And they spend most of their time looking after their health on their own. And that's obviously much more the case for conditions like asthma or diabetes or mental health, where good self-care is really the only way that you're going to have a good life. So we already have it. But are we doing it as well as we should? No, clearly not. Because healthcare, I think, sometimes soldiers on as if that wasn't happening. And as if it could be totally uncurious about how well people are equipped to do this self-care. So diabetes patients say they don't get asked whether they can afford the food that they need to eat. They don't get asked how they feel with their own mental health about, I don't know, their child just being diagnosed with type 1 or they themselves having put on a lot of weight and how they cope with that. And often healthcare soldiers on formal healthcare as if the main actor didn't need support in this, as if the patient didn't have to go on the pitch every day and play their best game. And I think there is something there about almost adopting the palliative mindset. And when I say that, I don't mean give up on people, but ask those sorts of questions that palliative care teams are used to asking. What makes for a good day? What do you want to be able to do again? And then work backwards from that to what healthcare needs to do in order to make that possible.
Jim, we've been talking about patient-centric healthcare for the better part of two decades. But in truth, patients on the NHS don't always have the same level of choice as patients experiencing other universal systems throughout Europe. So is one of the keys here to make sure that patients on the NHS are really in a position to make demands, in some ways act as customers and ask for what they want?
Absolutely. First of all, I would just go back and say, you know, I've known Charlotte a long time and I would agree absolutely with everything she's just said, and also what Todd's just said. There's a real danger we massively overcomplicate this thing. People's expectations are usually reasonable. And I think what we have to really, really resist now in the rush to recover is it becomes a technical process that's dominated by language about backlogs and inability to cope, etc. We need to be trying to carve out space for people to have conversations and feel like they've got some respect, some compassion. The bond between healthcare professionals and the patients is respected. And I think this massive pressure that everyone's feeling and the, you know, the daily narrative in the papers, etc., could really just push us towards a dehumanized phase where everybody's just so obsessed with counting widgets, etc. I forgot what your question was now because I was so provoked by the earlier comments. So I hope I've nearly covered the response.
Well, Jim, certainly conversations are going to be necessary and helpful for patients to know that they're being listened to. But if the health secretary is anywhere close to being on the mark when he says that this number could go up to 13 million on the NHS waiting list, at some point soon, those conversations aren't going to be enough. Patients are going to be demanding more and more action. And other parts of Europe having a universal healthcare system but allowing for more patient choice, even before the pandemic, were able to tackle their waiting lists in a more efficient way. Is one of the answers to what we've just experienced going to be making sure that patients really feel like they have a choice in the healthcare they're being provided?
Absolutely. Well, and I think a lot of people are unaware of their choices now. It was a big thing 10, 15 years ago when we had the whole choice policy. So the problem with choice and making choice very clear to people is there actually has to be reasonable options. And when everybody's full, busy, limited capacity, stretched workforce, there is a danger that we go down a choice route and offer choices that really just don't exist. So that I'm not aware of a single empty hospital, for example, that has loads of clinicians sitting waiting around to shorten everybody's waiting time. So I think choice probably is more about the interactions that have already been discussed about what does a plan look like, what does success look like, what happens when, rather than the whole hospitals trading and competing with each other and patients being able to say, well, I'm waiting too long there, I'll go to the hospital 20 miles away, because that's not going to get anybody anywhere, because, you know, there isn't anywhere for those patients to go. And then on just the final version of what we're discussing now, I think there is a power in liberating the patient and allowing the patient to tell us what they want, interact with us, that will point to innovations that we can make. And I think we're missing the power of the patient-driven innovation at the moment.
Charlotte, I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, because the idea of listening and telling patients that this is led by them is all good and well, but if the end result is essentially telling them, sorry, you actually don't have much of a choice here, the situation is as it is, and you're just going to have to wait, well, that doesn't actually feel very patient-led, and it doesn't feel like they have a lot of control over, you know, perhaps one of the most important things in their lives, which is their health.
Yeah, I think in a way, as Jim said, we've tried to push this agenda that people should be able to choose suppliers, if you want to call it that. And I don't think that's going to improve quality of care or experience very significantly. I mean, just geographically, if you live in Jim's patch, where else are you going to go? You know, that's a big county. And you're not going to drive 400 miles south or 200 to see, you know, to go to a different hospital. So it's, there's geography obviously in the way, but also people don't have the knowledge. People do not understand what their experience would be like in Leeds rather than in Manchester rather than Southampton. That's not something that, and I don't think we can overcome these knowledge inequalities really very easily. I think choice is much better conceptualized as being able to influence the quality of provision by the system understanding what people actually value. So I'm a bit worried that the bill and the reform and the stuff it says about procurement, you know, in an attempt to do away with competition and some of the stuff that the system has experienced is cumbersome, in a way says, you know, if the NHS agrees that they're providing a good service, they don't need to retender the service. And I just sort of think, have we asked any of the young people who can't access eating disorder services as to whether eating disorder services in this patch are any good? You know, have we asked any of the women who wait 7 years to have their endometriosis diagnosed about what they would like to see from a gynecology pathway? Or are we just saying, oh, it's good enough. We've tried hard. Let's retender. Let's recommission the same people, you know? And we, I don't think the people who spend the big money in the NHS necessarily understand what people living with conditions value. And I think making that understanding available to decision makers would drive up quality of care much more than individuals saying, oh, I'll go to Leeds rather than to Manchester.
Todd, AbbVie has been looking into this idea of patient-centric healthcare. Why is a pharmaceutical company like AbbVie interested in how patients are seen too?
At AbbVie, we would be proponents of a concept called shared decision making, which gets back to your choice question a little bit earlier. And it's our belief that patients will get their best, individuals will get their best outcomes if they are part of the decision making process with their clinician, and that they're part of the choices that they make in terms of managing their own healthcare. So this is just a philosophy that we believe at AbbVie. I think that one of the ways that we'll have to come out of the acute COVID period and through the recovery is by looking at technology, for instance, as an approach. And I don't mean, you know, I think when you say technology, you mean people automatically think about, you know, virtual interactions with their clinicians. But what I actually mean is looking at medicine technology as an example. And so I think a very, very good conversation, a robust conversation between the clinician and their the individual that they're treating is really, really important to make sure that the individual has the right mindset in order to get the best outcome. I think you can look at this shared decision making at the point at which the individual meets with their clinician, but we're also very supportive of the NICE shared decision proposal and guidelines that have just come out on June 17th, and they're taking it up now to the access level. But the patient has to be seen in every single part of the pathway. That's just a philosophy that we ascribe to here at AbbVie.
Jim, what happens when preferences clash? For example, COVID has moved much of healthcare online, leading to the NHS considering a total triage system where every patient has to go through a virtual or phone appointment first before seeing anyone in person. But it had to U-turn on that in May after patient backlash.
So at different stages around the country, we're seeing the public effectively voice their concerns about the method of access that they've been given or restricted to. And there's a lot of discussion going on currently about fatigue of digital access in primary care. And whether there's much evidence and science behind that or not, there's a very strong view that we're seeing a bit of a revolt from the public about not being able to see human beings. And what we've been doing in an outpatient setting where we went from 90-odd% virtual outpatients during the first round, is in every specialty, every team working through how that gets rebalanced to allow human interaction where necessary, but not give up on the technology. So I just think it's a much more nuanced thing than it was originally presented. Again, massively oversimplified. It'll just get rid of all the waiting list if everybody just goes online. And it doesn't work for everybody. It's potentially very risky for some kinds of patients and some client groups. So a lot of the things that we're talking about at the moment are about mental health, safeguarding issues, child protection issues, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think another colleague, it might have been Charlotte, mentioned inequalities earlier on. You know, if you're a single mother with two children at home, isolating from school, sharing one gadget, us trying to insist on a digital access for that person probably is just very stressful. It's probably not going to allow us to really deal getting access to the people that that need that kind of access. So I think we have to accept that this phase is complicated and probably needs a lot of more nuanced conversation and space for conversation. This isn't a factory. It's not a machine that can just treat everybody in exactly the same way. And there's a price of that, but my view would be dealing with that actually massively outweighs the cost of just doing it all in a traditional way.
Well, Todd, speaking of technology, it's not just virtual consultations, but other areas where tech can play a key role, can't it? There's talk of exciting things like genome sequencing to truly personalize healthcare to each patient's genetic profile, robotics to carry out things like fetal scans.
Yeah, and I think, just to build on Jim's point, you know, not every technology is going to be right for every individual. So this is where, again, choice comes in. And where clinicians may have to think about how they schedule their day so that they have face-to-face appointments maybe at one time. But there are individuals that actually would prefer to be seen through a technology like Zoom that could be supported at some other time during the day. So I think the technology, we shouldn't just rush and think that that's the answer to all questions. But to the specific technologies that you talked about, which I'm not an expert in, but it makes this point in delivering healthcare, this time in delivering healthcare, you know, so exciting. You have the technology, and then I would also reference the government's recent release of the Life Sciences Vision, where they're really taking a comprehensive view on building life sciences here in the UK, which will absolutely positively have a positive impact for patients in the long term in this country. I think with technology marrying up to the vision that the government is providing and the investment that the private sector is willing to make, we're at a really exciting time period for how healthcare in the UK can pivot based on what we've learned, not 180 degrees, but enough so that patient satisfaction continues to improve.
Charlotte, as technology advances, this has also raised data privacy concerns. NHS England and NHS Digital have recently had to delay a mass patient data scraping scheme, which is thought to affect 55 million patients due to campaigner backlash. Here's the MP, David Davis, who was part of the anti-scraping campaign, talking about it in Parliament.
Every couple of years, Whitehall, like an overexcited teenager expecting a new mobile phone, becomes fixated with data. Most recently, the power of big data mining, and I'm sure not just under the influence of Mr. Dominic Cummings. The Department of Health wants to open our GP medical records, 55 million data sets or thereabouts, to pharmaceutical companies, universities, and researchers. Managed properly, that data could transform, innovate, and help overcome the great challenges of our time, like cancer, dementia, and diabetes. These are proper and worthwhile ambitions in the national interest, and I have little doubt that that was the government's aim. But this data is incredibly personal, full of facts that may harm or embarrass the patient if they were leaked or misused. Unfortunately, in keeping with the Department of Health's long history of IT failures, the rollout of this programme has been something of a shambles.
Now, the scheme deadline, the end of June, was eventually delayed to later this year, but it will come back. Despite this, I don't think many members of the public will have even heard of this scheme. Can you explain what it's trying to do?
I can. I'd quite like to just quickly pick up on a sort of technology point more widely. We've done two pieces of work during the pandemic around this. The first one's called The Doctor Will Zoom You Now, and we listened to people's sort of first experiences of going online as patients, which was obviously new to almost all of them, because the percentage of people who had phone calls or remote care was very small before the pandemic. And we heard a lot of positives. You know, I would agree with Todd, this works for a lot of people and for a lot of issues. And it's probably best not to think about people, but to think about issues, because I certainly would choose it for some issues, but not for others. I think a lot of people are like that. But then we also, because we felt we hadn't really done justice to that by this very quick piece of engagement, we went out of our way to find people at risk of digital exclusion. We've recently published a report called Unlocking the Digital Front Door. And we conducted some of the interviews through interpreters, and we really went out of our way to find people who might find this quite a struggle. And what we heard was really not encouraging. And what's become very clear, I think, is that digital exclusion layers on top of existing inequalities, and it makes people who are already just hanging on in their ability to access services feel like they've lost that ability. And I think it's against the backdrop of a lot of other services people who've got complexity going on in their lives maybe in the past would have been able to rely on. You know, the people we spoke to did not have access to social workers, did not have access from housing support and so on, but they've just about managed to hang on to their access to primary care until the point where they were told they couldn't just walk in, they couldn't just ask for an appointment. And we are actively excluding people then. We are actively contributing to the inverse care law because we're dealing with the people who've got the most complex needs, who need healthcare the most. The other thing we learned very clearly was if you ignore the stated preferences the patient has for whatever reason, and you might have very good clinical or managerial reasons to say, no, we make this an online appointment, whether you like it or not. If you ignore the stated preferences the patient has, and that goes back to your point about choice, you end up delivering very poor quality care. And we heard a lot of examples from our interviews, from our field work, of people describing shockingly bad quality care because they couldn't understand what was being said. You know, deaf people on the phone, people not having interpreters, people having language barriers, people being totally befuddled. What's the point of that? You know, that was a totally wasted appointment with a very expensive healthcare professional. So I think if you think you've got too much pressure on to personalize, think again. If you don't personalize, you're going to deliver very poor quality care. On your point on data sharing, I think it's just beyond words how disappointing it is that the powers to be walked again into this trap around not communicating this properly with the public, about assuming the case has been made for the benefits of data sharing, and then getting carried away with very unclear communication and at pace. This was all entirely predictable. What worries me a little bit now is that I think we can't afford to be set back the way we were set back by care.data. We can't afford to lose another 5 years because to me and to many people, the benefits of data sharing are super clear. And what is slightly worrying is that what we're hearing is that the strategy now pursued by the people who are trying to convince us all to remain consented in is that they emphasize the benefits of data sharing. And I think the benefits are clear and the public are broadly sold on this. What we need to hear now is safeguards for how the data will be handled. And that's what people want to hear. They do not want to hear that this is all great and it will save lives. They want to hear how we want to stop abuses. And we all know of abuses of data use now. You know, we've grown up around large corporations not handling data well, and this is clouding people's judgment. So I think we need to address those concerns quite explicitly. It's a little bit like the vaccination campaign. You can't just field actors and footballers and assume it'll work. You need to actually address the concerns people have.
Charlotte, some campaigners have complained that they weren't consulted about how they were going to launch or sell this new plan to accumulate patient data. Were you consulted?
Very late, when it had all gone a bit the wrong way around.
Jim, what happened here? This isn't the first time that the NHS has gotten into trouble for its plans on patient data. In 2019, a deal was struck with Amazon, which meant that the tech giant could harvest NHS England's patient data for free. Now, this stuff could give Amazon a real edge in the health tech sphere. Does the NHS properly understand the value of its data? Could it not have struck a better deal? And does it need to communicate what it's trying to do to the public much better?
So I think there's definitely a communication issue. And I think there seems to be an anxiety about having a proper conversation. I would agree with Charlotte. I think most people are actually sold on the benefits and want to have, going back to the earlier point, want to have the respect of an honest conversation about how this all works. We can't guarantee there won't be problems with release of data and leaking of data and, you know, et cetera. It's a very complicated thing trying to make everything secure. But at the very least, we can have a conversation about how we mitigate those risks and safeguard against them. And I think that's absolutely necessary. So it felt like we had an opportunity to have a bit of a proper conversation with the public, and it was shortcut, and that's backfired on us. So we need to go back a few steps again. And on the value point, I have been worried over the last couple of years that you hear about people doing deals here and there about access to data. And there is a huge risk of all of that, that we actually dilute the value of the proposition. The NHS, you know, the reason this is all attractive to those wanting to pay for access is it's the world's most comprehensive healthcare system with a fantastic set of data, which is hugely valuable. So I would like to feel more confident that there's actually a thorough process to safeguard the value for the NHS, because it actually could make a really significant contribution to assisting our recovery. And also, just very finally, we've got to not forget the staff in all of this. You know, the staff have had a bit of a tough 18 months. This is by far the hardest wave for us of COVID. You know, we've had huge absences in the last couple of weeks as everything's been eased. It's really, you know, that's combined with a massive increase in demand, people trying to get on top of backlogs. Everybody's really, really tired and fractious. If you'd asked me 6 weeks ago whether the last 2 weeks would have been the worst 2 weeks since we started COVID, I wouldn't have believed that. It's been absolutely horrendous. And not because we're completely full of COVID patients, because we're not. It's just really messy.
Todd, last question to you. You have an international background, having worked in healthcare in countries like Ireland, America, and Canada, as well as the UK. As we move from conversations to action, what is there going to be to learn from these other countries as we try to deal with these backlogs and even the problems that the NHS had before the pandemic hit?
Yeah, I think I would first say, having worked in a number of countries, having come here, I've been incredibly impressed that the public owns the NHS, and the reverence for the NHS and what the NHS has not only been able to accomplish in this period, but historically is held to such a high regard. You don't see that across many other health services. And so I think that that allows the NHS to have a reasonable conversation with individuals under its care to set expectations. So I think there's a realism there and there's a respect there that doesn't always exist. From my perspective, coming from the perspective of a pharmaceutical company that lives and dies with innovation, you know, I'd like to see more collaboration, more partnership, like what we saw during the acute phase of the pandemic, with the private sector in a really meaningful way, with real urgency, because there, I think there is a lot from an innovation perspective, not only across the pharmaceutical industry, but all other private industries that serve the healthcare sector. There is a real desire to work with the NHS in order to implement and scale innovation, whether it be medicines or other technologies, with pace. And it's just somehow difficult to find the best pathway for how to do that. So I would say that other healthcare services that I've been involved in, probably scale innovation more quickly is I guess what I would come away with.
Well, Todd, Charlotte, and Jim, thank you so much for joining me.